It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
On to our weekly chat with Green Party co-leader James Shaw. I continue on the discussion on the emissions trading scheme, in which they're hoping to increase the price from $25 to $35 per tonne as a tax on companies producing greenhouse gases. The scheme is currently seeking submissions from the public and is due on 28th this month. I had a look on the website because I was trying to wrap my head around on how this, the carbon trading tax thing works, but basically you can trade things for a carbon credit, and so certain entities in the ETS that emit greenhouse gases must pay units to the government, and then entities that remove greenhouse gases, like those in forestry, can earn units from the government in which they can sell to companies that emit, if that makes sense. So since the 1990 to 2016, greenhouse gas emissions have gone up nearly 20%. And so I talked to Dr. Mike Joy, who is a researcher at Victoria University, who sent me a submission from economist Jeff Bertram, who wrote a few criticisms on the proposed emission trading scheme. Forgot my words there for a minute. And so this morning, when I talked to James Shaw, I brought up some of these criticisms and I heard his response. And so I begin by asking James to respond to Jeff's criticisms on the lack of transparency in the proposed bill.
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the major modifications that we're making to the emissions trading scheme, is to introduce much more transparency into it. So, for example, we're going to require that information about who holds what units is actually publicly available, because at the moment you can't see that. So that's a and actually that's something that the European Union does in their scheme, as well as some other jurisdictions around the world.
Because it seems like, you know, he felt that there will be an unfair and distorted allocation in how, you know, which places were being taxed and which companies were going to have to pay more. Or So how exactly would the scheme work in terms of determining who would be covered under the scheme and what, you know, exactly they would be having to pay?
Well, I mean, it applies to all companies in every industry outside of agriculture. And actually, it applies to agriculture in the sense that it covers carbon dioxide emissions, which, you know, farmers and agricultural businesses that use fossil fuels, for example, they still have to pay as well. So there are no exceptions in that sense. And there are companies that receive an allocation from the government in order to sort of account for the fact that countries that we compete with don't put a price on their emissions. That is also transparent. So, for example, it applies to all tomato growers who use carbon dioxide as part of their process. It applies to the steel mill, to the aluminium smelter, and so on.
And how does the scheme interact with, I guess there's an international, the Kyoto Protocol, so how does it interact with internationally carbon emission trading that occurs?
Well, at the moment, it doesn't. Mm. So you might have remembered a few years ago there was a huge scandal where we discovered that a lot of the units that were coming into the country were effectively fraudulent. We were receiving units that weren't actually based on real carbon emissions anywhere in the world. And so one of the things that the previous government did was to close the border, essentially to say, look, we're not going to be accepting any more international units in. The price had dropped to virtually nothing, so it wasn't effective in reducing New Zealand's greenhouse gases. And the units that were coming in, a lot of them weren't actually worth anything in real terms. So at the moment, it's closed. Our government said that we've got no intention at the moment of starting up trading with other countries again. And as we transition from the Kyoto Protocol to the Paris Agreement, which happens this year, that system will actually disappear.
Is New Zealand at risk of fraudulent claims domestically? So what kind of transparency or accountability measures are in place so that New Zealand doesn't have the same issue?
Well, we have a very high integrity scheme. The only way of generating a unit is to receive from the government or from a, for example, a forestry unit, and all of those are verified. And so, you know, because it is actually a fairly straightforward scheme in that regard, you know, you can tell if a forest exists. So it's difficult for someone who wants to issue a unit to say it's based on the sequestration of carbon dioxide in a forest if that forest doesn't exist, because we can actually see it. That's the advantage of having a domestic-only scheme, is it's easily verifiable.
So what currently is the cap, and who determines, you know, the rise in cap and what that exact number is?
Well, it depends what you mean by the cap.
Right.
Because there's currently a cap on the price, which is at $25 a tonne. Which happened, what that means is that if someone a polluting company, for example, decides that if prices get to more than $25 a tonne, they have the option of simply paying the government $25 rather than to pay the price above that. Now, we're looking at shifting that from $25 to $35 for this year, and then essentially, from 2021 onwards, there's actually a virtually new scheme in place. There'll be a sort of an upper price, but that'll move up and up from $35. And so what we're proposing is that once we get the advice from the Climate Commission, it will tell us what that future price cap should look like. The second type of cap is the cap on the total volume of pollution that we're allowed to put into the atmosphere. And the whole idea of an emissions trading scheme is it's supposed to be what we call a cap and trade, but ours hasn't had a cap on volume the whole time we've had it. And so that's one of the biggest things that we're looking at changing, which is to bring in a total volumetric cap, and that the starting cap would be 2020 emissions. So the idea is that actually from 2020 we would not increase our emissions at all, and in fact they would start to come down over the course of the next few years.
And so with that financial cap, so that first cap you talked about, is $35 enough? Because currently it sits at $25 and not much has changed, so not much has happened under this scheme in terms of decreasing greenhouse gases. So is increasing it by $10 and just moving it upwards, is that the best way to decrease it?
You've got to trade off two things. So first of all, the price has not been at $25 for very long. And so we haven't yet started to see much activity of what would happen if it stayed at $25. We know that a number of companies have started to make some material changes. For example, Synlait in the South Island, which is a dairy company, decided to install an electrode boiler rather than a coal or a gas boiler because they could see that the price of CO2 emissions was rising. And while an electrode boiler is a lot more expensive in the short term, they said over the lifetime of that boiler, it would easily pay for itself, because they could see that in the life of that boiler that the price will rise to over $40 a ton, which is the break-even point between an electrode boiler and the coal or gas boiler. So people are already starting to make decisions because they can see not just what the price is today, but what the trajectory is. We know that at $35 a tonne, that activity will increase, and so you'll start to see some dramatic changes. We also know that as the price rises beyond $35, that you'll start to see a lot more significant change as well. But the problem is, if you simply lift the price from $25 to, I don't know, for the sake of argument, $100, then you could see very dramatic increases in prices in the short term, and that would cause a significant economic impact, particularly on low-income households. And so what we want to do is we want to raise that price, but we want to do it at a pace that can be absorbed and that can be planned, and it's transparent and people can see what it looks like, and it gives them time to switch to alternatives and thus to manage any changes in price.
Yeah, because one criticism brought up was, you know, Jeffrey was concerned that electricity prices would rise up as well, and that, you know, that would impact a lot of households, and that a lot of electricity was making the switch already from renewable. So
actually what we're seeing is that the price of new renewables is cheaper than the price of existing fossil fuel plants. So something that's happened fairly recently is that the price of installing and operating a new wind farm has gotten cheaper than the price of operating an existing gas plant, and that includes any cost that the gas plant cost to build in the first place. So you're actually getting to the point now where electricity companies are able to say, well, we're actually going to start taking some of our fossil fuel generation offline before the end of its lifetime, because new renewables is still cheaper than operating that existing plant. And so I think, you know, because electricity companies in particular have been able to see and have been heavily involved in you know, looking at what this pathway is going to look like over the course of the coming decades, and they know that we've got to get to 100% renewable electricity over the course of the next 15 years. I think what you'll start to see is electricity prices either remain stable or possibly even start to fall.
Do you mind explaining to me how this is a cap and trade scheme? So one criticism was that you know, Jeffrey was saying that this was just a carbon tax. It wasn't a cap and trade scheme.
Well, that's what I was saying before. Is that there has not been a cap on the total volume of emissions that we've allowed through the scheme. So while it's applied a price, it hasn't actually said that there's a limit on what you can do. And because the price had collapsed, because we had, you know, the previous government changed the settings basically to gut the scheme, what that means is that there was no real price incentive to switch, and also there was no total volume allowed. And so that is the biggest thing that we're introducing, is to introduce a total volumetric cap at 2020 levels and then to start to decline that over time.
Okay, so it's two caps, both a volume and a financial one, that's working together.
That's right. Yep. So the idea of the price cap is that will move up. The price cap exists purely to manage the impact on the economy and on households as we go through the transition, and that'll rise over time. We're introducing the total cap on pollution at 2020 levels, and then we'll be decreasing that over time.
Okay.
So it's what you could describe it as a sort of a sinking lid, starting at 2020 levels, that you won't be able to pollute any more than 2020 levels, and then in 2021 it'll be a little bit less, and then in 2022 a bit less than that. And so you can see, as the population increases and as the economy grows, that's going to get quite challenging, because companies are going to have to work out how to decrease their total volume of pollution, rather than simply pay the price of that pollution, because and that's Jeff's criticism essentially, is that people have just, they've had the opportunity to kind of pay to pollute, but without actually reducing pollution.
I'll bounce into the next topic I wanted to touch on, which reading up that recently that the wait list for public housing has doubled in the last 2 years, and it's like reached a record high. So he's moving on to the new decade. What's being done in terms of support, in terms of housing?
Well, you've probably also seen a headline saying that we built over 3,000 public houses since we came into government, and we're looking to double that in the coming year or two. We've also seen the highest rate of building consents issued since 1974. So we're now getting back to a level of construction that we had in the early 1970s. But in the early 1970s, the population was about half what it is today. And so even that high level of building isn't catering to the high level of demand and population growth that we've got. So that's one of the pressures. The other thing, of course, is that, you know, house prices are still stratospherically high. That gets reflected, and availability of housing is still low, and that gets reflected in rental prices, which, as a student, I guess you would be pretty familiar with just how exorbitant rental prices are. And so that's obviously leading to more and more families putting their names forward for the emergency housing list. So, you know, although we are actually building more state houses than we have in over 20 years. And although we've got the highest rate of housing construction going on since 1974 in total, unfortunately, it's just not yet enough to keep up demand. You would have seen a headline last week that the government's just allowed Housing New Zealand to double its borrowing rate, which should therefore obviously enable it to double the rate at which it's building houses as well.
There's one, you know, one obviously with the opposition and then currently Labour, Green and NZ First, you know, there's a lot of comparisons about how many homes are being built, how many houses, and one criticism that's popped up is that it's not a useful conversation to be comparing the numbers necessarily and to get to the root cause as to why these rates are so high. And then also recently a survey came out, I think it was the International Housing Affordability Survey, that said that New Zealand was, you know, severely unaffordable. So why is that?
Well, we have we are one of the least affordable countries in the whole world for housing, and Auckland has been either number one or in the top five for least affordable houses for some years now. And you know, I mean, I take the criticism that getting into a sort of a blame game, you know, about who did what and when isn't terribly useful, and we need to focus on what's happening now and what's going to happen in the future. But we do have some lessons that we can learn from history, and one of those lessons is that you shouldn't be selling off state houses, which is what the national government did. Since they started to do that in the 1990s, there is a direct correlation between that and the availability of housing and pressure on house prices and homelessness and other issues related to low-income houses, low-income households and their abilities to get into homes and to stay in homes. And so that is why we've basically reversed that, and we've started the largest state house building program since, in at least 20 years, if not longer than that, actually.
Mm. Because, I think lower social economic communities do really suffer and feel the burden of this, you know, housing crisis.
Yeah, they do.
And at the same time, you know, the report that I was just having a read said that the middle class as well, in particular, who weren't able to get interstate homes or receive government grants, was also really struggling. So in terms of the middle class, what's being done to support that?
Well, that is where That's where it's relevant that we've got the highest rate of building consent since 1974. That's not just for state houses, that's for all housing stock. That basically means we just need to be bringing new houses onto the market as fast as we can. A lot of the work that we've been doing as a government over the last 2 years, particularly in relation to changes to the Urban Development Authority, changes to the Resource Management Act, and so on, are all built with that in mind, to basically make sure that we can accelerate that rate of house building.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.